From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
And joining us is Kim McCoy. He's an oceanographer and co-author of the book Waves and Beaches, The Powerful Dynamics of Sea and Coast, which is just about to be re-released by Patagonia. Kim, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Nell, and thank you, Chris. Glad to be with you.
Well, before we dig into the science in this book, we wanted to talk a little bit about the story behind it. The book was originally published in 1963 by your co-author, and it sounds like also kind of your mentor. Can you tell us a little bit about the original edition of the book and kind of who its audience was, who it was written for?
Yeah, let's see. The first edition was published by Doubleday. It was part of a little science, almost a pamphlet. And Willard Bascom had a very diverse background and spent most of his career, adult career, in the oceanographic world, coastal. He was a geologist by training. And I got to know Willard Bascom pretty late in life, and then we became friends. And I had used the first edition of the book as a graduate student. Never knew Willard Bascom. Great little book. Really enjoyed it. And fast forward a couple of decades, and I met him. So we ended up becoming friends, and he had just reacquired the rights to Waves and Beaches from Doubleday and was thinking about doing a third edition. A second edition came out in 79 or 80. And he would give me things to read, pretty much like a mentor, father-son relationship. And some people said I was the son he never had, and he was the mentor I never had. So it worked out pretty well for both of us. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he handed me the second edition of Waves and Beaches one day, said, "Hey, tell me what this needs." And I was taken aback, and I was like, "Me? I'm going to try and correct Willard Bascom stuff." So I took it on, and I went through it, reviewed it for him, and gave him my view about what it needed and how it might need forward projected. And that was the beginning of our collaboration. Unfortunately, he was hit by a car a few months later and died. And that put a big pause on it. His estate asked me if I wanted to do the third edition, and this is the completion of that long labor.
Wow. Well, what a special opportunity and kind of incredible way to honor his legacy as a friend, almost family. As I think about this book, it's as you page through it, at sometimes it feels like a textbook, and other times it feels so literary, and I found it hard to even classify what it is. How do you describe this book when somebody asks, what is this book, Waves and Beaches, that you came out with?
Well, it's really a hybrid of Kim and Willard. It's crosses adventure with equations, and hopes and aspirations for the future, and lessons from the past. It is difficult for me to actually classify it, and I'm loath sometimes to be boxed in, because how does one quantify how the earth, the atmosphere, and the waves interact with the land? It's fairly complex. It's emotional for some people, and it's straight mathematical for others.
Sure. Well, regardless, it's an interesting book to read. Frankly, just this morning, I got a little carried away and was late to the station. So,
is that why you were late?
Okay. Yeah, it is.
Acceptable.
That's
now.
A legitimate excuse, right?
So, Kim, you've been in oceanography for decades. What are some of the major trends you've observed with respect to global warming impacting our beaches and our coastlines?
Well, we're just beginning, so it's a combination of measurement techniques and forward thinking. So, for instance, I've done 9 trips to polar regions, and it's easy, much easier to recognize large change in the polar regions, because when ice is no longer ice, it becomes liquid water, that drastically changes the dynamics. So the polar regions are really easy. Now, in Texas recently, we had a change in the jet stream. People call it frequently the polar vortex.
Right.
And basically, it's winds that circle the globe at high latitudes. And the instabilities become larger as the temperature gradient becomes smaller. So that means the instabilities in our climate are driven, and there are people that argue one way or the other, but in general, you can even do this little experiment yourself by pouring water on an inclined plane. A steep plane will go super fast and have a narrow stream. And when it's flatter, it just sort of spreads out more. That's sort of what the jet stream is doing in three dimensions.
Right.
So we're noticing big changes in our atmosphere-ocean interaction. And then in the coastal regions, in the low-lying regions, I'll choose a couple of locations here. For instance, the Outer Banks in the U.S., in the Carolinas, they have periodic storms. The intensity of hurricanes are statistically stronger. And so you get a very strong, we've had a lot of them, but it doesn't matter. The weak ones don't matter that much. Things sort of return to normal. However, the intense ones, the Category 4 and 5, it's like a blender going through and it just stirs everything up, so it's never the same. In the Gulf Coast, so let's move down to Florida, where the sort of Tallahassee area, that's in a watershed that is really starts in Alabama and Georgia. And what happens upstream is really determining what happens at the beach. So when you combine larger storms with a deficit of water or sediments, remember if you put a jetty somewhere and you funnel the water flow, it becomes more intense and pushes more sediments out. On the other hand, if you protect wetlands with jetties, so because you want to have navigable waterways, you reduce the sediment load that reaches the beach, and then you get erosion when a storm comes through. So, or you get, I think it was Hurricane Harvey that pushed in, it was a 1,000-year storm, I think they called it, and it pushed an immense amount of sediment, not out to the banks, out to the barrier islands. This is in the Gulf of Mexico, off of the coast of Mississippi and New Orleans. It pushed the sediments off into deep water, which doesn't build up the coastal region. And then let's move further to the west now, where you are. Mm-hmm. So in Utah, you are in the upper reaches of the Colorado River drainage, right?
Correct.
So I think around Grand Junction, you have a series of rivers that's in Colorado. So it's really Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona are in the watershed of the Colorado. So what happens in eastern Utah, and I think you're involved in that area, what happens, what gets put into the watershed there ends up in the Sea of Cortez. Well, it used to.
It used to.
There's so much water being pulled out of the Colorado now by the adjacent states, including where I am in California, that no water flows into the Sea of Cortez anymore.
Right. And what impact does that have on the Sea of Cortez, either physically, chemically, or biologically?
All of the above.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a physical oceanographer, so I deal mainly with physics. However, things sort of spill over into each other's disciplines. There used to be a large, I can't pronounce it, it was a large fish, looked sort of like a sea bass, and it grew up to 10 or 12 feet in length. Fishery that was there for forever. It disappeared because the nutrients that used to come out of Colorado no longer reached the sea. The sediments have dried up, so the marshlands that were really, really rich in primary productivity, the photosynthesis, and then the small little animals and organisms that thrive in marshlands, wetlands, those completely disappeared because it's parched. I think there's a picture in the book showing the mouth of the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. It's sand, and there's an old boat that's just sitting on the sand. Mm. There's no water. So I don't know how you can change it any more than that.
Right. One of the other focal points of the chapter on kind of climate and waves and beaches focused on some of the Pacific Islands with a highlight on Kiribati. And I'm hoping you can tell us that story. Again, I think we often hear, oh, sea level rise, it'll put these places at risk. But your description of kind of the processes and the feedback loops was really interesting to me.
Yeah, Kiribati is in the tropical Pacific. Kiribati was the location of immense battle during World War II between the Japanese and the Americans. And then later on, there were nuclear tests that were completed in that area. And the people of Kiribati, somehow they survived, and they're still living there. Many of them have been translocated. However, what's happening now in Kiribati is, and this is well documented now for couple of decades, the sea level is rising, so it's relative sea level. I can explain that later, but sea level's rising, which means the depth of the reef is different. It's lower. So what happens is when a storm comes through, you get water being driven up over the reef. That's the spur and groove alignment. And those fingers, if you will, of the reef reach out in the direction of the prevalent wind wave direction. Now, not only has, it's like a triple whammy with Kiribati, and it's happening in many other places, the wind has intensified, so the wind climate, that's statistically, but it makes bigger waves. The direction of the storms has changed, so the spur and groove alignment is no longer the same. Then the water that's pushed up over the reef and into the lagoons, that is now saltier and more intense. Then the changing temperature of the seawater has caused a massive coral reef die-off. So even if the spur and grooves were aligned properly, they're not there anymore. So there's, I forget the number, it's something like 60 to 80% of the coral reef is not recovered from a bleaching event that occurred 5 or 10 years ago. So Kiribati is really in difficult situation. Of course, the people that live there need to have fresh water, and they pump that out from below where they live. And that area has now been inundated with salt water, so the aquifer, the groundwater that they've been drinking, is now higher salt content from the seawater. So it can't get much worse, and Kiribati may be the first country in the world to actually cease to exist. They've actually been relocating people for over a decade. They're buying some land or being allowed to live, I think, in some Australian territories.
Well, what coastlines are, in a sense, next? You know, if Kiribati today, what areas of the world most concern you as far as their loss and the relocations that might be required?
Well, these aren't hypothetical futures. Right. The city of Jakarta in Indonesia has been battling sea level rise. Now, it's local sea level rise. Part of that is global sea level is rising, but also when liquids, usually water, but also hydrocarbons, not in the case of Jakarta, but mostly water, is pumped out, the earth goes down. Water comes up. The city of Jakarta is currently being planned to be moved by the government of Indonesia. Hmm. They've spent about 20 years battling rising sea level, and they're losing the battle. I think they built about 20 kilometers, it's 12 miles roughly, of seawalls and barriers. But it's a losing battle. Off of Bangladesh and India in the Brahmaputra-Ganges Delta, where they've suffered terrible storm surges in the past. In I think it was 1970, a hurricane came through, typhoon came through and killed an estimated 500,000 people. Now that was, 50 years ago now? Weather changes and local climate affects areas. So the Ganges-Brahmaputra Delta, I think it's 10 million people roughly that they figure will be displaced, and they're already being displaced. The Mekong Delta in Vietnam, which is the result of, I think it's five countries are in the watershed of the Mekong Delta, and that's sinking, and lots of barriers have been built up so that when there is a big rain, the groundwater is not replenished and sediments are not, I'll call it dendritically, it sort of reaches out like your fingers in a random pattern. They're not spread randomly, they're spread directly out to sea. So it's a big problem. In California, we have erosion just south of San Francisco. There's a town that has been it's falling into the sea. There's right. lots of it's in Pacifica. So there are lots of things that are happening. Meanwhile, here in San Diego, when I turn on my tap, the water that I get really is coming from you guys. So we have a long distance relationship, whether we know it or not.
Right.
The water that you utilize or through hydraulic fracking is compromised. That ends up in the Colorado drainage. It is then pumped, some of it, to different metropolitan areas, including San Diego and Los Angeles. So we're all connected, and it's almost everywhere you look in the coastal zone, there's something going on. On rocky headlands and rock and things like that, it's not going to change much. If you live on a promontory and it's granitic or pretty solid rock, it's not going to change in your lifetime. But in areas where there's slopes of beach slopes of, let's say, 1 to 50 or 1 to 100, that means a 6-inch rise, and we've had about 6 inches of rise. It's about 15 centimeters of sea level over the last century. That means whoever's living on that coastal zone in Mississippi or Louisiana is going to lose about 50 feet of their land.
Right.
It's not going to exist anymore. And it's not hypothetical. These things have been litigated by the federal government, and the people not only lose their land, but they lose their mineral rights. It's not trivial. It's nice to think things are always in the future, but they're here on smaller scales.
You know, I thought that was so interesting that you pointed out kind of that associated impact of people's property rights as water levels rise, and that changes kind of the public domain and the private land. Real quick, if you're just joining us, we're talking to author Kim McCoy of Waves and Beaches, which is just about to be released by Patagonia in its third edition. And I wanted to ask you, you know, as the title would probably reference, a lot of this book is about the waves themselves and the dynamics of the water. And I'm curious, has, you know, the climate dynamics changed the waves themselves? Are we seeing different kinds of waves now?
Not different kinds of waves, but it's subtle. So big things can change at very small length scales. So you know, a person's head of hair is one hair at a time, so to say. statistically, so once again, we have massive ensembles of sensors on land, in the sea, and also from satellites. And now we have much more data to look at these things, so we can look at things statistically so that we can say, ah, yes, there's been a 1% increase in the amount of energy being dissipated by winds to the waves. So you have a 1% increase in the energy in waves in a little area. Now, it might just be over a decade. Okay, but the decade makes makes a difference. If you're just growing one little hair every month, right, it ends up being substantial in the long term. And we know also that the intensity of the Atlantic hurricanes, the U.S. has more data on the Atlantic hurricanes than the typhoons in the Pacific. We know that the intensity has increased. We're seeing more high-speed storms, so wind speeds that are higher, and we know that winds create the waves. Another really subtle thing that actually isn't well known, but hardly even researched, is viscosity. So that sort of the almost the stickiness of a fluid, its tendency to resist shear, technically, and its surface tension change with temperature, very slightly. But these very slight changes in the surface tension, which is the very essence of wave formation, and very small waves or capillary waves or things that are just the width of your fingernail in wavelength, and they come in little groups, and there's a picture of it in the book, of capillary waves. And these things form differently if the surface tension changes. Okay, how does it change? Nobody knows. Nobody's looked at it, but it is changing, and likewise with the viscosity. So surface tension is what makes a drop of water round and makes water sort of not flow away on the surface of a table or something. Alcohol, for instance, flows away because surface tension is different. Water balls up. So little things are changing, and the big things are changing. We know that now much better than a couple of decades ago because we didn't have the sensor data to put it into large computers. Not large computers, but computer models. And you end up having the ability to predict things with higher and higher accuracy. Just because something doesn't happen exactly as predicted doesn't mean one knows nothing. So the ability of meteorologists to predict the weather is getting better and better as a function of time. So if I'm going to try and predict what the weather is going to be in Utah tomorrow, it's probably pretty good because the guys in Colorado, NCAR, they collect a whole bunch of data, and it's only a day out, and things don't change a whole bunch in a day. But as humans have become better at projecting things, we can predict more 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. So our accuracy is getting better. So the margin of error is decreasing, and that comes with more data. So we're seeing things that we haven't seen in the past, and what we're seeing is not very good. Everyone speaks about atmospheric CO2. Well, the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere is higher now than it's ever been in the last few million years. It's remained below about 300 parts per million for, I think it's 3 or 5 million years. It's now over 400,000, and there's a direct relationship between carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the global temperatures. We have not yet started to decrease the rate at which it goes in, let alone the absolute number. So every year it goes up, goes up, goes up, and everyone talks about it. So there are things that you can do, but those are things that other people have written lots of books about. There are a few references in the back of the book about coastal climate change plans. There's about 10 or 15 of them in the appendix. And so there are some recommendations and directions given in the book as to how one can become active in one's life by following the examples of what people have done already. We don't have to invent anything, but if we don't change what we are doing with the rate of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere, we will have to be inventing new things.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It's being released by Patagonia on March 16th, so in just a few weeks. Kim, we just want to ask quickly, if people are interested in learning more about your work or finding this book, where should they go?
Well, Patagonia has it on the website. I've lived below the radar a lot in life. I've spent decades all around the world, and I went to university in Germany, France, and England, and lived in Italy, and I've lived in seven countries. So I've tried to keep below the radar because of a lot of things, but certainly through Patagonia, people can get a hold of me. And if people really want to change their lives, I hate to use the phrase, but, you know, think globally and act locally, because we all can do things. As I said earlier, Nell and Chris, we do have a long-distance relationship. I live in your watershed. We live in the same one. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be asking what town you live in, but what watershed do you live in? And we're all connected, and the sooner we recognize it, we need to disregard international borders and have a group solution to this. I'll give a little anecdote. It's in the book.
I'm going to jump in and say we have about 1 minute left.
Okay. Well, Walter Monk, who was a pioneer in wave forecasting, lived to be over 100. Here in San Diego, they had a little event for him and gave him an award named Walter Monk Way along the coast here in La Jolla. And he was very sage. He said, unless we have a concerted effort on an international scale, unfortunately, Walter Monk Way will not live to see its 100th birthday. Mm. It will be underwater.
Well, let's hope we can make that concerted effort happen.
Well, I'm trying to provide information so people can make informed decisions.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
That was Kim McCoy, the co-author of Waves and Beaches, a new edition updated for surfers, sailors, oceanographers, climate activists, and those who love the sea. Kim, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you very much, Chris and Nell.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.